You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. I'm Al Voner, and this is The Public Eye. Nice to have you with us this Sunday evening. Once again, and I've said this many times, being a history buff, I love coming across books that really cause you to take a step back, think everything through. I always consider that a very good book, and a most recent one is a book entitled The Failed Promise, Reconstruction, Frederick Douglass, and the Impeachment of Andrew Johnson. And my guest is author and educator Robert Levine. And for the next half hour, we'll be talking with Mr. Levine about the book and the idea of someone being impeached. And then we're going back to mid-19th century, shortly during and after the Civil War. I think most people think of modern-day impeachments as the only time when America took that stand. Not necessarily true, but we'll be talking to Robert Levine, as I said, for the next half hour, and we'll get his view. Bob, nice to have you with us.
It's great to be here, Al. Thanks.
You've been a historian for years and years and years, but does it surprise you that even as far back as the 1860s, mid-1860s, that we were talking, or that the country, I should say, was so divided? I know the Civil War was in play, and we know that the South and the North had major differences regarding secession and racial issues, especially as it relates to slavery. But this idea of impeachment, strike you as odd?
Actually, no. So I'm thinking right after this. I mean, what strikes me as odd is impeachment now compared to right after the Civil War, because right after the Civil War, so much was at stake. What was the war about? What was going to happen? And lo and behold, someone comes into power who was not supportive of ideas about Reconstruction. And at the time, he was supposedly a Republican, but had been a Democrat, and the Republicans in power wanted to do something in terms of creating rights for black people and thinking about how to change the southern states, and this is a person who was resistant. So huge issues, lots of key players, and yeah, so it's always, it makes sense to me that there was impeachment then. The terms of the impeachment turned out to be kind of strange and ineffective. But the Reconstruction period that a lot of historians now are going back to and saying this is one of the key moments in American history was a fraught, highly conflicted time. So, yeah, the fact that a president was impeached then makes sense to me. And then some of those issues of the late 1860s are still in play today, but I don't think it's going to lead to impeachment for the same sorts of reasons.
Right. Another thing that struck out in my mind reading the book, and I was familiar with, I had read biographies about Frederick Douglass, African American spokesperson, a very eloquent spokesman, a man who, certainly was front and center during the Civil War and shortly thereafter. But this. I guess you would say this split between him and Johnson. Johnson at first making it sound as if, we're going to make sure that we have voting rights for black Americans. We're going to do away with slavery. Everything's going to be fine. And yet Frederick Douglass, I think from the very, and I want to get your sense on this, from the very beginning, felt otherwise, that, it sounds good, maybe too good to be true, and then shortly thereafter finds that this man was basically just spinning tales.
Right. So let me just say what the main contribution of the book is, at least as I think about it, and that is that it reasserts the importance of Frederick Douglass in the period right after the Civil War. So people who know Douglass tend to think of him as an abolitionist, and someone who was really active in the 1840s and 1850s up to the Civil War. They might know a little bit about him during the Civil War, and then he kind of vanishes from people's thinking. But Douglass was extremely active in American culture from the end of the Civil War up to the time of his death in 1895, and was and really regarded the early years of the of Reconstruction as the key moment in American history. Could slavery be brought to an end in very real terms? So let me just give one of my favorite quotes from Douglass, and this is from 1865, a few months after Johnson was inaugurated. Douglass says, "Slavery is not abolished until the black man has the ballot." And it's really fascinating because slavery had been abolished by the 13th Amendment, but Douglass is saying, no, blacks still need to have the vote. Blacks still need to become full citizens. How is that going to happen? Can Andrew Johnson make this happen? If you look at, and it sounds like you've read a lot of history, if you look at the major works on Reconstruction, they're all about how the white Republicans were fighting against Johnson. Every now and then, you hear a little something or other about Frederick Douglass. So what I tried to do in the book is put Douglass front and center, to put a black perspective front and center, to try to understand why, and to me this is another fascinating thing about the book, why Andrew Johnson actually seemed to hold so much promise, because in fact he was one of the few pro-Union Southerners, and he had done things prior to taking the presidency that suggested that he cared about black people and wanted blacks to have equal rights. He almost immediately turns against some of that thinking. And then as you read the history books, people like Charles Sumner from Massachusetts, Thaddeus Stevens of Pennsylvania, Benjamin Wade of Ohio, these three leading white Republicans are leading the charge against Johnson. But where's Frederick Douglass? And as I show, he's everywhere, and not just Douglass, but a whole group of black activists who are calling for black citizens' rights and also pointing out that there were problems north and south with racism. So another kind of preconception is that this is a north versus south problem. But as Douglass and other blacks noticed, every time a black suffrage bill came up for a vote in a northern state post-Civil War, it was defeated. So they're fighting Johnson. They're raising questions about racism, and they're saying, we fought in the Civil War for you. There were several hundred thousand blacks who fought in the Civil War, and we can't vote. And, you know, these are the kinds of issues that I think resonate today as well.
Yeah. I want to expand on what you just said about Frederick Douglass and how, what a prominent role he plays. First and foremost in your book, but in American history. But
right.
I just want to take a quick pause. Remind folks that you're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. This is The Public Eye. I'm Al Vona, your host. My guest this evening is educator and author Robert Levine. In his new book, The Failed Promise, we're talking about the amazing accomplishments. I know, Bob, it may sound like, he didn't really accomplish. I think he laid the groundwork for what is even transpiring today, and that is, as you said, you brought first and foremost Frederick Douglass, a name that most people who are familiar with history, especially historians, are familiar with, black suffrage and wanting equal footing for black Americans shortly after the Civil War. But yeah, I was amazed. The traveling he did, the speeches that he wrote and then
right.
talked about, the audiences that he drew. Most people would think, well, it must have been just a handful of, African Americans, following, their leader here, if you will. He really captivated people from around the country, did he not?
Yeah, absolutely. He became a celebrity during the 1840s, going back 20 years before the Civil War, speaking in places like Boston. And I'm pretty sure he spoke in Worcester. He spoke around the country. And in 1845, when his famous narrative was published, he had to go abroad to England, Great Britain, because otherwise he might have been caught and taken back to slavery by fugitive slave hunters. And he becomes an international celebrity. People love him in Great Britain. They love him in Ireland. And when he comes back in 1847, he sets up his own newspaper. He continues traveling around the country, though not to the southern slave states. And after the Civil War, he's giving speeches to thousands of people. And he was a brilliant rhetorician, by which I mean he understood his audiences. So one thing I do in the book is I look at a famous speech he gave in 1867, and he gave the speech to black audiences, and he gave the speech to white audiences, and he knew how to change it. So he appealed to black anger when he was talking to black audiences, and when he spoke to white audiences, he appealed to what he called white goodness. You know, you can make things happen. He was so famous that he was invited, actually, to visit Andrew Johnson in the White House, which he did in 1866. But he was part of celebrity culture, and back then, orators were the celebrities, because we didn't have TV or radio.
Right.
And so there were lyceums, these speaking venues, and Douglas was someone that you actually paid money for. I mean, when I've looked at these speeches, people would pay 25 cents, which was a lot back then.
Right. You know, the other thing that came to mind, I wanted to ask you, because even after finishing the book, I'm sitting here thinking, if Andrew Johnson were pro, the vote for black Americans,
right,
and more progressive and more honest, in his approach to all of this, because there was pending legislation. There were plenty of people in Congress who favored that. Would that have made Frederick Douglass's life easier?
I guess so. Maybe he would have had to do something else. He is always fighting for black rights because they're hard to come by in the United States. So, ironically, because Johnson opposed black voting rights, and those weren't the only issues for Johnson. The Northern radical Republicans were also concerned that he was basically saying, yeah, the Southern states could be just the way they were before the Civil War, except without slavery. They can be run by former Confederate generals, things like that. So he believed in restoring rather than reconstructing the states. But the irony is that precisely because Johnson was so recalcitrant, the radical Republicans managed to pass the 14th and 15th Amendments, 14th bringing citizenship to black people, and the 15th Amendment bringing the vote. So that's 1870, and Douglas in 1870 is celebrating that. By 1871, Douglas is saying, hey, wait a minute, there's Jim Crow practices, and black people, although they have the constitutional right to vote, they can't vote. He is fighting from 1870 to 1895 for black vote, black rights, as things get more and more reactionary. So by the time Douglas dies in 1895, there's been an upsurge of lynching. It's virtually impossible for a black person to vote in many black states despite constitutional amendments, and that's what he's talking about, and that's what he's fighting for. And you could say that's the legacy of Reconstruction, and so that's why today people are saying, oh, you know, these laws that are being passed in Georgia, Texas, and other places, this sounds like Jim Crow. And I think it's why people are finding my book so speaking in such vital ways to right now. So when I wrote the book, I was thinking about impeachment. I was thinking about Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
I won't tell you what I think about Donald Trump. I'll just tell you I was thinking about impeachment and Donald Trump. I had no idea that there were going to be laws passed that would make it more difficult to vote. As I've been getting the pre-publication and early reviews of the book, people are responding more to the issue of black voting rights,
right,
than to the issue of impeachment, you know, the issue that we started our conversation talking about. So when you look at the book itself, the book is on my breakfast table right before me, The Failed Promise. I mean, the title speaks to right now. Like, what is the promise? The promise is, there's a bunch of promises, but one of them is the promise of democracy, the promise of the Declaration of Independence. That was Frederick Douglass's favorite founding document. And is democracy being threatened right now? And I'll just leave that as a question. But I'll say that the book focusing on the period 1865 to 1868 provides a prehistory for some of the issues that we're facing right now.
The other thing that stuck out in my mind, and I've been wanting to ask you this, is the fact that when you, again, you don't have to be a trained historian. If you just love America and you want to know something about American history, and hopefully it's still being taught in schools the way you and I remember it, but, hundreds of thousands of lives were lost during the
right.
Civil War. It was the one time in American history when, you know, it could have gone the other way and this country could have been split. So, but my question is that shortly after and during Reconstruction, you would think that the South would have been totally demoralized, and maybe to some extent that they were. But I get the sense that in spite of the major losses of property, lives, and everything else, they lost the war. Instead of going forward and kind of, you know, working shoulder to shoulder, and as you said, right up to this very day, they dug in their heels.
Right.
And I'm just perplexed by that, because when you think that someone has been, you know, well, we beat you. We beat you fair and square. It's over. It's done. You've surrendered. Now you're going to play ball by our rules. It never
right.
really played out like that, did it?
No, it didn't. There's a recent book. I think it's called How the South Won the Civil War. I think it's by Heather Cox Richardson. I could be wrong. But the argument is that ideologically the South ended up winning the war by pushing notions of white supremacy and notions of states' rights. So that takes me back to the perspective I tried to develop in the book, which isn't a triumphalist notion of, you know, the North beat the South and all these wonderful good things are going to happen, but it's the notion from a black perspective that racism is incredibly ingrained in the entire country, not just the South. And so the battle that Douglas and his associates are fighting, it crosses sectional lines. And I have an epilogue where I trace Douglas from 1870 to the time of his death. I mean, he's upset with the Supreme Court. He's not just upset with, you know, particular Southern states, and he's upset with the de facto segregation that's developing in places like Massachusetts, for example, which actually is my home state. I'm from the Boston area. You've a couple of times said that I'm a historian, so I think I should correct you and say that I'm not. Even though I wrote a book of history, I'm a literary scholar, and I've done a lot of writing on Nathaniel Hawthorne and Herman Melville, while also writing about Douglas for the last 30 years. And the reason I want to say that is that this is a history book that spends a lot of time looking at the words, at the language of the key players. Mm-hmm. I read through the 15 volumes of Andrew Johnson's writings, and I have things to say about his speeches and the rhetoric of the speeches. I've read everything that I could find by Douglas, and all of that is part of the analysis, but I decided to write a history book, so it tells a story.
Yeah.
And the story is the unfolding relationship over 4 years between Douglas and Johnson. No one's ever told that story. You know, what happened when Douglas first met Johnson? What happens when Douglas visits him at the White House? Why it was that Andrew Johnson actually made a job offer to Frederick Douglass, despite the fact that Douglass was one of his most severe critics, how Douglass and his sons responded to the impeachment itself. So I try to tell a story. The story builds from the actual words, the language of the key players, and then because I wanted to do a history book, I did a lot of historical research as well. But I think it's a slightly different book than some of the history books that I've read in the way that it pays attention to the language of the major people that I discuss.
Well, I think I might have said it at the outset that you're right. The first few chapters, you get the sense that, you know, this guy, Frederick Douglass, who in my, you know, he's almost a parallel of, you know, the more modern day MLK, if you will, Martin Luther King, if you
Absolutely,
will.
Absolutely, yeah.
But his writing is eloquent. And these, I mean, he had, there was nothing he could have, it's not like, well, you know, where did he get it? Where did he copy this from? I mean, what book did he steal those words from? They were his own, and they were passionate, they were strong, they were forceful. So the point I'm getting at, and I think you bring it very clearly in the book, did an excellent job of bringing forth the fact that the black community during and shortly after the Civil War and you know, up to his death, Frederick Douglass was their shining star. Let me ask you this. Had he not lived, had he not been the eloquent speaker that he was, and maybe things didn't move as quickly as he would have liked in his lifetime. You know, we're starting to see progress being made today. I know it's been a long time since the Civil War, but would black Americans be in a worse position if it were not for Frederick Douglass?
Maybe. I mean, it's hard to say. And one of the things that I emphasize in the book is that Frederick Douglass did not act alone, that he went to black conventions, that he was friends with people like Francis Harper, George T. Downing, Henry Garnett, Martin Delaney. There were a lot of major black spokespeople out there. In history, it seems that Douglass has eclipsed them. At the time, though, I think he was part of a larger black community, mm-hmm. a larger community of activists.
Yeah, and rightfully so, because he had something to say, and he said it in an intelligent fashion. You know, we haven't got a lot of time left, but I do want to bring in the fact, because we've kind of touched over it. Even his sons, it was two sons, right, that actually kind of followed in his father's footsteps, and were pretty much just as eloquent as their dad, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So I just want to add to what I was saying and then turn to the
sons. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Go read every book ever written on the impeachment, and you will not find a footnote to a black newspaper called the Christian Recorder, which was the most widely read black newspaper during the time. It was the newspaper of the African Methodist Episcopal Church. It was a cultural organ. It published Douglass and many other black writers. So I just want to say that you read that newspaper and you say, wow, there is a black community out there. Douglass had three sons, two of whom were activists who worked with Douglass. There is Lewis Douglass, who became a journalist, and when Frederick Douglass and a black delegation visited Andrew Johnson at the White House in February 1866, Lewis was the secretary. He may have written the response to Andrew Johnson that was published right after the meeting, and he went on to try to pursue a career in journalism. Charles Douglass, the third son, worked for the Freedmen's Bureau in Washington, D.C. He was an activist, and during the impeachment, and this is another part of the book that I think is an important contribution, he wrote his father a series of letters about what was going on during the impeachment. So I think Douglass was concerned that if he went to the impeachment hearings, all eyes would be on him. People would get distracted from Johnson. And so he kept a distance, and he let his son tell him what was going on. And what his son had to say is, Johnson was a bad or evil president who deserved to be impeached and then convicted because of the things that he failed to do in relation to African Americans. The impeachment itself was about Johnson breaking the Tenure of Office Act by firing Secretary of War Edward M. Stanton. It was about what writers of the Christian Recorder and other black newspapers said, legal quibbles. It avoided the big issues. The Republicans were trying to kick Johnson out of office for firing a white man because it broke a rule that they had put in place in March 1867. And Charles, the third son, was writing to his father and saying, this is crazy, you know, that Johnson should be convicted because of the harm he's done to black people, and that's what the trial should be about. And it ended up that is not what the trial was about, much to the disappointment of Douglass and his entire family.
Needless to say, the book Failed Promise is a must read, whether you're a major history buff or not, or especially of that period of time. As I said, I think it was one of the most pivotal times in American history. But Robert Levine has really brought to light the fact, as he said, that Frederick Douglass and many others were ardent supporters and the voice of the black community, during and shortly after the Civil War, and kind of set the tone for much of what even transpires to this very day. Robert, real quickly, if people want to reach out to you directly, how might they do that?
If you just type my name and the book title into Google, you get a hit on my author's blog, and I'm not sure if I have the address right, but you can get it on Google. But it's go.umd.edu/Robert S. Levine, and the blog, it's like an author's blog. It has my email address. You can also get it from the University of Maryland Department of English, not History, Department of English, where a professor. And so, yeah, I'd love to hear from people if and when you read the book in particular. The author's website that you get on that goumd.edu will have kind of a list of my other books and some recent op-eds that I've published in the Washington Post and elsewhere on black voting rights.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's quite a bit of that, and I really urge people to do that. But more importantly, the book itself, The Failed Promise, Reconstruction, Frederick Douglass, and the Impeachment of Andrew Johnson. Just a great read. And Bob, you know, kudos to you, because it's many times scholarly works will be, a lot of people say to me, well, that's for people who are strictly historians. Well, right. Not necessarily. This is very user-friendly.
Right. I wrote it for the general public. It's published by Norton, which is a trade press, and pretty easily available.
Yep, and it's, as I said, a great read, especially wanting to, it once again fills in the puzzle, or the blank, I should say, in the history of this great country. Any questions about the broadcast, you can certainly give us a call here at the studios at WICN. Our main number is 508-752-0700. You can pose any comments, questions, or feedback to me directly. I certainly welcome that. That's Al Vona, V-U-O-N-A, at WICN.org. For the Public Eye, this is Al Vona.